Thank you, everyone, for attending the Leadership and Life Insurance Failures What Can We Learn About Financial Leadership seminar. Bimal Balasingham and Andrew Brown are going to present this today, and I'd just like to take a few moments to introduce them. So Andrew Brown. Andrew has been a director of Lead First since 2011. Andrew partners with clients in building effective leadership cultures through developing leadership capability at the individual team and organisation level. He supports clients to address their business strategies through developing effective leadership mindsets and practices. Andrew is a member of the Actuaries Institute Leadership Committee, writes a regular column on leadership in the Actuaries magazine, and has been a lecturer in business writing on the commercial actuarial practice subject since its inception. Andrew's previous responsibilities include Chief Financial Officer for Philippine AXA Life, Chief Actuary for AXA Life Singapore, and Head of Learning and Leadership Development of AXA Australia. Andrew has been a council member for the Institute of Actuaries, convener for the Institute of Actuaries Futurism Committee, and member of the Global AXA Learning and Development Board. Andrew participated as a panellist in a keynote address for the 2011 Melbourne Business School Future of Learning Conference. And I'd like to introduce Bimal Balasingham. Since 2002, Bimal has been a senior advisor to Foolap Investments, sorry about the pronunciation, investment consultants in Vietnam, where he's establishing a greenfield life insurance startup. He's also a founding partner of Parmenion Capital Partners in the UK. His previous responsibilities include Deputy Chief General Manager for AIA and CEO of Krung Thai AXA. Bimal has over 27 years working experience in financial services, including Britain, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, Australia, Thailand, India, Indonesia, and Vietnam. And let me know if I've left anything off that list. He's particularly interested in the leadership development of executives in Asia. And it's now my pleasure to ask Bimal to come to the stage to present.
Hi. Good afternoon, everyone. One disclaimer, I'm not an actuary, so we've kept all the numbers out of this presentation. Okay. The beginnings of this paper started over about a year ago when Andrew and I were sitting having some coffee in Melbourne, reminiscing and exchanging war stories of successes and failures and missteps. And we thought it'd be good to try and understand the role of leadership in failures and what we can learn from them. We've kept the definition of failure fairly broad in the sense of trying to see any major, obviously material or permanent impact on balance sheet or profit and loss. So whether the thing collapses and it's shut down or it's taken over by somebody or requires significant capital injection or just a write down. So something major that's affected the organization. For the research, we did a literature review and a potted history going back to 1696, which is the start of life insurance in the UK. And we've also reviewed some papers, especially those that happen every time there's a cluster of failures, whether in the UK or Japan or more recently after the GFC. I would think that the most interesting piece of the work were the six case studies where we've had particular involvement in and how that's come out. And we've also talked to some industry players to get their inputs. We'll then go through some of the insights we get and the recommendations that we have. So we start... And when we looked at it, there were 400 failures. These are the actual closed down operations since 1696. 1696 was the first known case of a group of lives covered. And then 1699 was when they opened it out, or there was a separate organization opening it out to people, a general public to come in. So let me take you through this step by step. Start first, I think... looking at timeline and then regional. So from a timeline basis, I'm looking at 1700 till about 1900, and then 1900 to 1950, 1950 to 1990, 1990 to 2000, and then 2000 to now. And from a regional perspective, Europe, US, and Asia, we didn't really get too much information out of South America or Africa, but we thought these were cover enough information for us. So 1870 is a key year in the UK because of the Life Insurance Act, and actually came about because of a whole host of failures just before that. And I'll talk to you about that in a minute, but there were something like 285 life insurance companies set up from 1700 to 1870, of which 174 failed. And especially in the last few years leading up to 1870, there was a significant number. In the US, the first life insurance company was around 1759 in Philadelphia. And again, you see a lot of the situation where most of the companies that opened up closed within 1 or 2 years. Interesting time is the Civil War. After the Civil War, there was a large upsurge in companies being set up because the obviously with the payments that were made during the war and people coming back, families without breadwinners and so on. And there was a huge number of new companies set up, but within 10 years, 96 out of the 100 or so that came up failed, again because of competition, lack of knowledge, etc., etc. Australia pops up a couple of times here, first in the 1920s and 30s, and really I haven't been able to get much detail apart from the fact that there was a line in a paper saying 8 companies failed between in the Depression, and we haven't been able to drill down further on that. Japan life insurance started 1870 under the Meiji restoration, but again, significant post-Depression, post-First World War, and the whole industry was wiped out by 1945. This is partly because the government forced all of them to invest in munitions and overseas assets, munitions factories and overseas assets, all of which got wiped out. If I just pick a few other things, I think the 1950 to 1990, we didn't really find too many failures. But from 1990 onwards, things started to pick up. If you look at the US, they've got these charts that show you the average failure rate. I think that 2,800 life companies in the 80s and now it's like 1,300. But if you look at the 80s, it was, or if you look at the whole period from 1980 to 2010, average is at 0.4% failure rate. It peaked at 1.6% in 1991. It's come down till about 0.2% now, and it was about 0.6% before. So interesting times in the US. 1990 in Australia, there was the Regal and Occidental. Some of you may remember that. It was 65 million sort of disappeared from the stat funds. Westpac tried to help out. I think in the end, Mercantile Mutual stepped in. So there was a fraud situation there. Interestingly, the whole 90s was full of guarantees and high interest rates and falling down interest rates and junk bonds and real estate. So you can see it in the US, in Canada, in Jamaica, in Japan, in Korea, one after the other. There was a whole host of similar situations, negative spread happening. And then in the new millennium, you've got the US and Europe. Interestingly, we found very few cases before 2000. And after 2000, with the liberalization of Europe, more incidents happened in Europe. Here are some very specific cases that maybe I can just talk you through. Interestingly, 1857, the Ohio Life Insurance and Trust Company, actually it's more like a bank, but when the New York office closed, the latest technology at that time, which was the telegraph, spread financial panic. And for the next 2 years, it almost led to a bit of a mini depression from 1857 to 1859. As I mentioned, the Albert and European, two big life insurance companies in the UK, fell. And this is because leading up to it, a lot of the smaller failing companies were taken up by bigger companies. So the combined, these two companies actually took over 56 failing companies. And then they themselves failed, partly because of also over-bonusing and high expenses. But that really caused the 1870 Life Act in the UK. Guaranteed Security Life 1991 is quite an interesting one. The guy who ran it bought an island and minted his own coins. So interesting what what some of these guys do. Confederation Life was a typical guaranteed GIC, as they call guaranteed investment contracts. And the whole host in Japan, one after the other, all on. Most of them are mutuals, except I think Nippon Dantai was not a mutual. 1990, one company that we know a little bit about Nippon Dantai, and also First Life, which about 30 of us flew from different parts of the world to do a due diligence on First Life back in the late 98, 99, I think. And we were the fourth company into the data center and the first to find something wrong with the valuation. But very interesting operation, highly a high level of fixed costs and total disregard for assets and liabilities. Equitable Life, one of the interesting things about that was it was run by an actuary, a very strong-minded actuary, probably, I think, one of only three actuaries to be kicked out of the Institute of Actuaries. It took a long, drawn-out affair. It took about 7 years for him to go. If I look at AIG, interestingly enough, out of the $180 billion that was used to support it, $90 billion was real cash bailout. Only about $30 billion of that was in the hedge fund sitting in London. The 100 guys were doing all the credit default swaps. The other $60 billion was actually from the so-called stable life insurance companies. I remember, interestingly enough, and this is because of the too big to fail or too interconnected to fail, Martin Sullivan, who was the CEO who took over from Hank Greenberg in about 2006-2007, spoke at a Mumbai conference and said, when I take my driver picks me up in New York and drives me into my office, and I look at the paper, everything on that front page had something to do with AIG. Everything at all. And we talked to an auditor sometime later, and they said AIG was in every piece of the subprime mortgage situation, from mortgage origination, etc., all the way through. So it wasn't just the hedge funds and the CDSs. One of the things that, as we went through studying this, and especially looking at the case studies, which Andrew will talk about, is we have a feeling that there's this life cycle. I mean, it's just based on what we looked at. And we start with this idea, and probably this sits further up here, right at the top of the market, and there's a whole idea of everything's going well and we're fine. And somewhere along the line, a root cause happens when we don't really fully appreciate that was the root cause. Then emerging issues happen. Then the big crisis. There's a whole aftermath where there's blood on the floor. And then, surprisingly, sooner or later, the existing company, but maybe the industry, you're back again to feeling like everything's okay again. So as we went through looking at what caused these crises or failures, we came up with the four usual suspects that seem to come up over and over again. Policy guarantees, investment issues, either stock market, property, loans, those kind of investments. Fraud, which as I mentioned appears quite a few times, and external crisis. So this is like the depression of the 20s or World War II or the GFC. There are another six that we've picked up, but these deal sometimes with deregulation. So if you look at the Jamaica case, they deregulated, and within a short period of time, the banks and the insurance companies got together, and then five insurance companies and a few more banks failed. You've also got certain people going rogue. We've got authority to do some things and overriding the situation. Another is overseas expansion. A lot of people think that's diversifying, or as Warren Buffett said, it's probably diversifying, and you don't really understand what's happening. So there were about 10, but these four were the ones that kept coming up. There was a really good study done of 21 failures in Europe after 2000 by a number of people. And really what they said was, number one, you got to differentiate the technical causes from the root causes. And they did. They had a root cause analysis and a nice little template that separated internal, external, and worked it out. And the second they said is, most of these things that are happening are actually interconnected or interrelated. And I think that's a really important fact. There's no one cause. There's two or three things that come into play, and even more. The third thing they said was, the trigger events affected the whole industry sometimes, but some players obviously got badly affected and others didn't. They were more resilient. But they really pinned everything down on management, and they said at the end of the day, it's management. And they said these are the four big ones. Incompetence, and I think we talked about people going overseas when they shouldn't. They had a non-life company taking over a life company and so on. Lack of integrity, I think we talked about some of those cases. Taking too much risk and not understanding. And I think this is particularly related to the combination factors. As I was talking to somebody this morning, you know, you may have three factors coming together, but it doesn't multiply the risk three times. You may multiply the risk 30 times. And that's hard to actually pick up. And then there was this undue pressure from above, whether to make certain investments or to do certain things on sales or market practices. I'm going to pass it over to Andrew now to talk about the case studies and go forward on that.
Thanks, Bimal. Yeah. Okay. So Bimal just took us through the management root causes. When we started to explore our own case studies in either companies we'd worked in or worked very closely with and had a fair deal of an overview and understanding and appreciation, we started to explore whether those management root causes made sense or whether there was something else as well. And we've got six different case studies there. There's a little bit more detail and depth on each of those in the paper if you're interested in finding out more about each of those. The one that I just want to focus on for now is number four. So if you like, each of these case studies, they're from different size. Some of them are in Asia, some are directly in Australia. Some are related to guarantee issues and investment issues. Some are related to excessive competition. Number four is a particularly interesting one. In case study number four, this was a company which had very high level of capital, had excess level of capital, and it had a mandate to have the business grow quite rapidly. And what happened over time, as that business went about growing, there were a number of risks that started to see it in the business. That business started offering guarantees which were higher than just about anywhere else in the market. At the same time, the assets that business were invested in became progressively more aggressive over time. At the same time, it invested very heavily in group business. And one of my observations, I'm sure many people in this room have a similar observation, is often very easy to pick up large volumes very quickly into group business because of the way the brokers will tilt the business. So at one level, there's this nice story of rapidly growing, successful growth. But every time there was a minor blip or a crisis in this particular country, this organisation would be one of the ones which was more impacted than the rest of the market. And essentially, there were three or four crises which sort of led to the conclusion or led to ultimately regulator intervention in that particular one. When we went and... Back clicker work, yeah, previous... When we actually went and said, okay, what would we see as the root cause for that organisation, the question was about incompetence. Were the people in charge who made those financial decisions fundamentally incompetent? And Bimal and I had a long debate on this, and our personal view was that those people who took the most senior financial roles in that organisation were very capable, probably on all the roles they did leading up to the last role they took on. So it's almost like the Peter principle, yeah? Promoted into a role where potentially the consequences and things were larger than what they'd done previously. Was there lack of integrity? It's an open question, but we seriously question whether there was. Did that company take on too much risk? Given that relative to the rest of the industry, they suffered more significantly each time there was a downturn or a crisis and were much more vulnerable and much less resilient, the conclusion we reached was they took on too much risk. Was there undue pressure from above? almost certainly. So when we looked at that, we said, well, what is the root cause? And one of the feedback we got from the peer reviewer of this paper was, you've got to be nervous when you've got four or five different root causes. Are you really at the root cause? And when we started to explore that, the hypothesis that we have is that the root cause was probably the decision in the first place to put people in the roles who weren't necessarily able or capable to do those roles. And it then went down to, if you like, the root cause beneath a lot of those things came down to the selection of the senior executives. It came down to the people who made those decisions, and it came down to not having clarity around risk appetite and the people who were put into those roles having a very different risk appetite to the organisation. Does that make sense to people? Yeah. Right. So it became very much around, there was a root cause that sat below a number of those causes. And our hypothesis is most of the root causes, as we drill down in each of those case studies, come to leadership. So if we go back to the case studies, hedge fund activities of too big to fail life insurer leads to world's biggest bailout. Don't think you need to be Einstein to figure out who that's talking about. But what happened actually led to that? Why was that allowed to occur? And in each of these cases, when we drilled down and kept asking those questions, why did that occur? Why did that occur? We came to one key theme, and that theme is leadership. We backed this up with industry executives' inputs. Now, some of these were gathered in the last 12 months. Some of these, and in the paper, there's about 10 quotes. I just put up three here. But one of the quotes, we were determined to be number one in the market. At the time, we had an abundance of capital and were riding a very strong economic tailwind. Anyone ever heard statements like that before? Could be. The pressure and incentives from the global head office were tremendous. New business targets were extremely aspirational, and we chased any business we could get. Initial sales targets were met, but it went downhill from there. The productivity of the new distributors was three times that of our existing distribution channel. We gave them everything, and in the short term they delivered. It was 18 months later that productivity started to tail off, and we realised they may have been churning their previous client base. So decisions made at a point in time, they seem like a rational decision. We bring in a whole group of advisors. But what is that actually doing? What pressure is that leading to? What resilience or lack of resilience is that creating in those markets? When Vimal and I went through and said, what do we see then as the core derailers in each of those cases as we drilled down, we came to five key derailers that seem to keep coming back time and time again. The first one is hubris or overconfidence. Second one, myopia. Following the markets even when the markets are going down, not being able to take an external view, following internal practices even though the market is obviously changing. Abuse of power and lack of courage. We actually saw this as a two-edged sword, very hard to discern sometimes. Often there was a very strong power person in charge of the organisation or in charge of the next level up, whether it be in a regional office or in a global role, and lack of courage. How did people respond to that? How did they take the decision when they were asked to do something that was probably outside of what they thought was appropriate? Stuck in the past and cronyism. Mates and cronies was a really interesting and important one. And I think, Sean, in some of the research that you and I did in terms of talking to the executives of board, one of the key concerns of the directors was sometimes in organisations someone comes in and what do they bring in? They bring in their mates from other organisation, the people who they trust. We found a really strong and prevailing theme then many of these instances when people started to the roles they were doing a question, they were often supported to ride through those challenging times. And that's great, but there are some times when they might have been supported well beyond the point of being able to be successful in that role. Bamal, did you have anything to add to those?
No, that's fine. The only thing I would say is the guy who took over from Sullivan in AIG when he was asked by the Senate hearing, what would you do differently? He said, if I look back at my time, I wouldn't do anything differently. So that's really like, you know, on a different planet.
Yeah. 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 And what's really interesting about that is that these failings continue to happen over time. Right? We went back to 1696. Right? Some of the failures around investment guarantees you see popping up again and again and again and again. Many of the failures did. And so the fundamental question we had then is, if even despite regulations changing, despite awareness and understanding that these are issues, why is it as human beings, why is it as corporations, we continue to revert? And again, for us, the key theme or the key hypothesis there is it comes down to leadership. You can put all the regulation in place in the world, but you'll still have people who will be smart enough and shrewd enough to find a way through that if they so desire. So to look then at what we felt was an appropriate leadership model, self-leadership, people leadership, strategic leadership, you'll find those in just about any book that you have on leadership, right? There's, I don't know, was it 20,000 books last year published on leadership, and you can guarantee each of those themes will be there. We had two additional themes, one being around financial leadership and one being change leadership. The reason we brought in change is because we felt that as the world continues to evolve very rapidly, increasing complexity and everything else, change is getting increasingly more important. And there's self-change, there's people change, there's strategic change. But to actually drill it out and have it, if you like, as one course of leadership that goes right across all the other themes, we felt was really important. And the other one is specifically around financial leadership. When we did a literature review of financial leadership, the literature review was basically said financial leadership is what financial professionals do. The context of this paper is they were saying, well, no, financial leadership is actually the mandate at the C-level suite of every person. Every person needs to take responsibility for, at the C-level, at the exec level, of how they lead that organisation. We saw two themes around that. One is hitting your immediate numbers, which is really important. If you don't hit your numbers, you aren't going to be here tomorrow. But the other side of the coin is, at what price did that sometimes happen? So how do you actually go beyond the numbers, and how do you actually create something which has got more sustainability or resilience? So delivering your numbers was the first part of financial leadership, and the second part was going beyond your numbers. Warren Buffett, takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to ruin it. If you think about that, you'll do things differently. Yeah? So just in terms of some of the derailers, a couple of points I'll just close on and then we'll go to question time, is in terms of when we looked at hubris or overconfidence, one of the discussions we had is at the point in time when a CEO or a chief financial officer or a senior exec was put in place, they were probably put in place because they were seen as someone who was highly confident. Okay, so the decision made at that point in time was probably well intended by the board or whoever put that person in place. The challenge is, and it's very difficult, is how do you actually discern between hubris and confidence? How do you discern the people who may have that strong intention around confidence and other people who may go beyond that? And that is a real, real challenge. And again, it comes down to us, a challenge of leadership and a challenge of selecting leaders. We actually looked at each of the aspects that we found on a continuum. So, for example, beyond the numbers is a sweet spot. At a restricted going beyond the numbers, if we don't go beyond the numbers, we might be more risk-averse. We're not actually seeing the opportunity out of risk. If we go well beyond the numbers, it might be chasing risk for the sake of it. It might be a very pro-risk organisation. If we have a look at people leadership, we talked about mates and cronies. At the extreme end, if I trust someone regardless of all the evidence, then I'm no longer discerning. Yeah? So trust is really important, but if you don't have trust and discernment together, what will happen? What will happen is you're either going to have distrust and you never actually build anything, or you leave someone in a role where they may not be effective or are actually being more dangerous for the organisation. Another insight that we had, and I'm sure most people in this room will resonate with this, assumptions or scenarios can be chosen to achieve a particular perception of risk. In some of the business planning that we've seen and been implicated and involved in, is sometimes the question was not what is an appropriate assumption. The question sometimes might be, what is the assumption that will get me the outcome that I need? Right? Has anyone ever been in that conversation before? Good, okay, I'm not the only one. Yeah. Now, the challenge then becomes, for me as an actuary, is to put it back to that person saying, if you want to achieve that assumption, that's your role as a manager, and I'm happy to work with you about the uncertainty around that and what you might need to do, but it's a discernment between where there's uncertainty in acknowledging that and where it's an aspirational assumption versus when it's what I'd call false stability. Trying to actually create a sense of stability or certainty when the world is not stable or certain. Right? And we saw that, Bimal.
Just a few things to add to that. One is, every single one of those case studies had risk analysis done, sensitivity, numbers. So all of them were done in a very templatized, standardized way. But, you know, there wasn't any thinking that, or the person who wanted his particular business case to go through or his particular decision would position that in the right, in his way.
Right.
A classic example, sitting in a board meeting, a board member asks the CEO a question, and the CEO takes up this tome of stuff, puts it on the table. We had McKinsey look at that, and it's okay. And that was it. That was all you had to do to deal with that sort of... So you bring in a big-time consultancy. Mm. You can find ways to deal with any particular risk that you want.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you. And our observation is what those derailers tended to do is actually reduce the robustness of the organisation. The leadership derailers would often lead to either getting too high a level of certainty, meant that you might get certain stability in the numbers, but the stability was hiding the underlying patterns, was hiding what was happening underneath. So we actually saw those as key reductions in resilience. And I think that's an interesting insight in terms of some of the conversations that we've had in the plenary sessions around the opportunity and around creating resilient cultures. If you don't have the leadership in place, if you have those leadership failures, if you like, all those leadership derailers, you're much more likely to have less resilience. So we just had a few recommendations, and this could be a good thought provoker for our conversation. Success has many fathers, but failure is an orphan. We believe that a few derailing leadership attributes are the root causes of many failures. Yet how often do people actually use failure as a way of reviewing and improving things? And to an extent, that's partly the regulatory life cycle, and that's why, you know, we continually progress. But at the same time, when we look at the research that we found, these failures keep reoccurring. What is it that we need to learn or to learn differently? Second recommendation was selection, development and management of leaders is absolutely critical. That's one of the reasons we came up with that holistic leadership model. Now, our belief is there is no such thing as a perfect leader, and leadership is an evolving concept. It changes over time. What you might need as a leader today may be very different in 3 years' time. But the point around this is, if you choose someone, if you like, who might have exuberant confidence, and there is a concern that that could lead to overconfidence, the company needs to do something to ensure that they hold that person accountable over time. It's not enough to say, OK, we're going to take the risk. You actually have to manage that, and you have to mitigate it or make sure that there's things in place.
Can I just say a word here? So the point here is that you may actually make the decision to hire a bastard, because you need him to do something. But the question, are you big enough, bastard, to manage him? Right? And the story is Greenberg. So when Greenberg first set up the hedge fund in AIG, and he hired the big, you know, BSDs of the investment management world, the hedge fund world, within, I don't know how many months, he got rid of the biggest guy because he stood up to him and Greenberg just shot him down. And Greenberg to this day says, if I was there, this would never have happened. I know how to handle it. But whether you want a bastard to manage a bastard or not is a different question. The question is, when the board hires somebody, do you really understand whether he's capable of going to that extreme? And if he is, how are you going to manage it, rather than try to manage him after the fact?
Okay. I've already spoken about resilience. I'll move on to the last slide here and what actuaries. Lots of birds, different. The theme there is around thinking diversity. One of the key insights that we got going through the research is when some of the derailing activities happened, when failure often happened, there were people who had concerns, who raised those concerns. They weren't necessarily listened to, they weren't necessarily influential on how they raised it. What's really important if you're going to create a resilient culture, if you're going to be able to address and not continually have failures, is having that capacity to do that. Actuaries need to understand the impact of derailing leadership attributes on reducing the efficacy of their models. This is the intersection between the models we put up and the human behaviour, which while a model might look perfectly rational in a rational world, we're dealing with human beings. Actuaries need to contribute a diversity of thinking to improve the quality of strategic conversations with the board and the C-suite. Again, I think that was covered off pretty well in the plenary session yesterday afternoon. But for us, again, that was in our research when we came across, we believe that actuaries have an enormous capacity to do that, have an enormous wisdom around how businesses operate, and have a responsibility of having that occur. So with that in mind, I'm just going to share something with you. And this is a question, right? Failures, will they continue to happen? We've just had the GFC. We know a whole heap of other things have occurred. Regulators are coming in and cleaning stuff up. But will failures continue to occur? In our research, we came across this article. You might notice the date there is April the 22nd, 2013. So it's not very old. This article is about a hedge fund called Apollo, which has been investing, bought a life insurance company in the States, and there's been a number of hedge funds have been buying life insurers. And some of the investment assets include a baseball team, some infrastructure in Kazakhstan, and some of the GFC non-credit rated bonds and stuff that no one else would touch. Now, this company might be completely wise and brilliant. This might be a very small proportion of their portfolio. We don't know. That's not necessarily our observation on this. What we did observe was the regulators in the states they were in refused and didn't allow them to write the particular assets which were backing their annuity portfolio. So a very practical solution in the States is you go to another state and find another regulator. Okay? And in this actual article, if you're interested, just do a Google on Apollo and life insurance, you'll find that that's exactly what they did. The concern by some industry players is in the States you have these guaranteed pooled funds, so if an insurer goes belly up, the pooled fund comes in. The sceptics in the market are saying these guys have basically got a free option. Right? If it goes down, the pooled funds will come and bail out the policyholders. Point being that there are other challenges. There will always be ways around regulations. Unless you get to the root cause, nothing will change. So with that, over to questions.
Thanks, Andrew. That was a very thought-provoking presentation. Now, I'd like us all to learn from our failures in the past. And if you've got a question, can you please introduce yourself at the microphone? And don't all rush up to get the microphone, but is there any questions out there? Yep. There we go.
Robert Swillsmeyer. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on the paper. It's I haven't yet read it, but the topic is very... Thank you. I'm sorry I'm too tall. It's certainly a very important topic because, as you say, certain themes recur. I'm just wondering whether the word leadership shouldn't be expanded to governance, because the boards are very responsible for what happened, for selecting a bastard and not being bastard enough to control the CEO. And, you know, it's a whole issue of board governance as well as CEO and C-suite, and then, of course, the risk management process that the board insists upon.
Yeah. Can I take that? Yeah. There's a guy called Victor Palmieri in the States, and he's been involved in many failures. Saving them. Been called in to save them. And he has these six laws. So it's Palmieri's six laws. So if you get a chance to Google it. And the first law is about boards. So it says something like, you have individually, all these people are brilliant, high level of integrity, etc., etc. But when you put them all together, they become an incompetent bunch of nincompoops who haven't got the courage or the conviction, something like that. So I think there are thoughts in we kept away from this on this paper. We thought we'd dealt with a big enough topic at this moment, but I fully support what you're saying, having sat in some board presentations where we know nobody has a clue of what we actually say.
Only things I would add is I think around governance, the key challenge is that, yes, the governance is really important. Do you have the people in the room who are going to make sure that that is taken into account properly, and that when the shit hits the fan, people don't duck around it or don't actually look at other ways of doing things? And that, so root cause to me keeps coming back to leadership.
Trang Duncanson Deloitte. Unlike the previous person, I am just the right height. One of your five facets of leadership, you talked about change adaptive. That sounds reactive to me, and I was wondering in your research, how important was it to foresee change, or is that, you know, are people moving too far to the right in the spectrum there?
Yeah, okay. I think it's a, you know, it's a really, really important point that change leadership could rightly be seen as a perception of responding to change. For me, there's a gradation, and you'll get as we get ever increasing change in the world around us. To me, change leadership is actually having that external sight and seeing change as a real opportunity. So it's actually bringing in. I talk a lot about change and stability as being the yin and the yang. You can't actually change anything to a degree unless you have some level of stability in an organisation. So it's like governance, it's like clarity. People need to have some structure. But when you get that structure, that's when it opens up the space for change and the opportunity for it. When you don't have enough stability, or there's very little stability in the system, then the type of change happening will determine the kind of leadership that's necessary. So for some instances, it might be bringing clarity back. For some instances, it might be like safe fail tests. And that's one of the things that we propose in the paper, is that when you really don't know what's going to happen next, you might want to do some very small spods or very small projects to actually see what the outcomes would be. And so that's actually a way of building resilience in an organisation. Charles, you I know you mentioned to me about safe fail tests, or you mentioned that in a previous session. Have you got any comments to add to that? Okay, no, that's okay. No worries. Thanks.
For change leadership, I have two specific definitions. One is delivering planned change.
Yeah.
So you plan a change, you've got to deliver it. And the other one is dealing with unplanned change. And I think that's what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
And it is just so difficult. You need a whole dose of luck to make it happen. I remember 10 years ago, flying in from Melbourne to run a project in Singapore on financial planning, and that's the right place it's going to go. You know, 15 years later, you know, it's still agency.
Yeah.
Aaron Wimmel, thanks for your paper. It is a real thought provoker. I was interested that the title was about failures and not about success. And in your one of the slides, you said that, you know, success has many fathers and failure is only an orphan. And I suppose I've always thought of success and failure as kind of diametric opposites, but I suspect that it's not that simple. I expect that sometimes failure can actually be too much success, managed poorly in the wrong direction and stuff like that. And, you know, like your study didn't go... We're very impressed by Covey's studies that didn't go back as far as yours, where he linked the factors of success to characters rather than to character traits rather than to how-to-dos.
Yeah.
Any comments on those thoughts?
Andrew was pushing me to have more success. And, you know, I thought it was just too big a topic. Maybe it's the next paper for us to look at.
But, yeah. I just pick up on a couple of points. One is one of the expressions I often use is there's no such thing as failure, there's only feedback, right? And it's about when something doesn't go right, what's the opportunity to learn from it? And we felt that we wanted to narrow the scope of this because there's a lot of learnings and a lot of juice in failures which don't necessarily get out there. And for us, the key theme here is one of the key learnings is about leadership. In terms of COVID and character traits, I could put 15 organisational development specialists in this room and each one of them would have a different view. It's sort of like trying to get actuaries to agree on an assumption. And some people will say that character is 50 or 60% of what we're doing. A lot of the neuroscience and those type of research would suggest that probably about 20% of our neural pathways are what we're actually born with. And so that 20% then informs the other 80% that's growing. So how much of it's character? And of the 20%, a lot of that's going to come from my evolution, it's going to come from a background, but the 80 is going to be partly be coming from my environment, but it's also going to be influenced by the intersection with that 20 that was there to start with. Phil?
Can you go back to that slide where you had the list, the five starting with myopia and hubris?
Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Phil Stock.
Back a bit.
Thank you, authors, for one little paper.
One more.
Previous one. That's
it. Zero leadership is a root cause. I find an interesting observation how much, really, of the cause can be linked down to what you just mentioned as character, what I would call moral failure.
Mm.
One thing I've observed in life is that selfishness, which is the essence of poor character and moral failure, can always justify itself by looking at things in a nice short perspective. If you're only looking at the short term and what it's going to affect me, you can even justify anything. And that's obviously the myopia side. And of course, cronyism fits into that as well, because if you just want to focus on the short-term need, then obviously the thing to do is to call into play the people who are going to have a similar perspective to you and the yes-men syndrome. And I think the definition of hubris is when you start believing your arguments when the arguments are obviously flawed.
Yeah.
And I think, that's something that we need to realise is that, as you said, probably a good part of that 80% of that failure is simply because the essence of moral failure in financial matters is greed. And greed, you can always find an argument to justify why, if you put money into the ostrich farm, you really will earn 30% per annum rate of return.
Yep.
And I think really that summed up where the problem is. But, it's not that the bad decisions can't be justified. They always can be justified if you're scheduled.
Yeah.
Sorry, Phil, I'm going to have to cut you short there because we've run out of time.
Okay.
If you have a reply, reply.
This is a 20-second reply to a 1-hour question.
Okay.
And it goes to my mind around how do adults develop through life, and there's three phases. We go from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric. That's the development pathway. And what you're describing is that some never make it, right? But we're all on that journey. And we've got to, one, have the humility to understand the people on that journey. No one's perfect. You're not going to get a perfect leader. But at the same time, you've got to continue pushing towards that world-centric view, which is much broader, much more longer term, and in the interest of the health of the system.
And I just want to, going back to the ancient Roman times, when the generals came back in the triumph and they're walking down and everyone's cheering, the Romans made sure somebody was whispering into the general's ear, "You're only mortal."
Thank you.
So please join me in thanking both Andrew and Bimal in their great presentation.